back to the Leading Yourself podcast. I'm so excited for today's episode. It has been a while since we've had a guest here on the podcast. And today, Scott Miller is back to talk about his most recent book, Career on Course. Scott is a mentor, a friend. He's the host of the number one leadership podcast in the entire world, the On Leadership Podcast with Scott Miller, a Franklin Covey podcast. He was the CMO of Franklin Covey, where he spent 25 years of his career. Now he is an entrepreneur, an author who has published multiple books, including this last one that you're going to love. So let's dig in into today's episode. Welcome to the Leading Yourself podcast. This is your host, Carolina de Arriba. I'm an HR professional, health and fitness coach, wife, mom, and above all things, a goal-getter. In this podcast, we're going to be digging into all things leadership, professional and career development, habits, and relationships. This is a podcast for those who want to become the best version of themselves. Those who have big dreams and are willing to embrace the journey and put in the work to achieve them. My goal is to share with you the tools, tips, and tricks to help you in your journey. So let's dig in into today's episode. Well, it's such a pleasure and a privilege to have you back, Scott, here on the Leading Yourself podcast. It's amazing to talk to you, and every time we get to talk is because you're launching a new book, and yet here we are talking about your latest book, Career on Course. How have you been?
Well, I've been great, and we have to stop that. We have to have lunch or a conversation that isn't about you interviewing me on my next book. I kind of feel like they're our books because I always ask you questions and you offer feedback and you're helping me support. So someday I'm going to be interviewing you about your book on my podcast, and I look forward to that.
I am looking forward to that. But let me tell you that this book, Career on Course, which is officially launched, we were just talking offline that I'm celebrating my second anniversary at the company that I'm working at right now. And I know the process that led to writing this book was a little bit the reverse process from other books. You had a coaching module that inspired you to write this book. And I went through that, and that inspired me and helped me making the decision to switch companies. We're going to talk more about that today, but I want to tell you that I'm here today and I'm celebrating 2 years and really happy with my career move because of the advice I got from you through what now is your book, Career on Course.
You are the first podcast host that has ever said that, because I don't think most people know that it was initially a course called Ignite Your Genius that several thousand people and companies put their employees through. And then a publisher approached me and loved that course and renamed it Career on Course, which I love. And so you're absolutely right. The book is the result of several thousand people attending the Ignite Your Genius course. And so thanks for reminding me. I actually hadn't talked about that in a few months or so.
Yeah, which was a great course. And you even were offering live Zoom calls for anyone who wanted to join. So I know that this book, even though it just launched, it has already impacted thousands of people.
Thank you.
With the content. And talking about that, this is the first book that I think is not really targeted to a niche reader. Because all your books have been very targeted to marketing leaders, to people leaders. And this one I feel is like for everyone. Can you expand a little bit of what motivated you to write the book and expand your target audience in the way that you did with this book?
You are exactly right. For those of you maybe watching your podcast, you can see behind me, my first six books were pretty niche, right? They were focused on management or leadership or mentorship or marketing. And this is the broadest book that I've written. One is because, kind of like you, I'm obsessed with helping people, right? You are a coach, you are a career advisor, you love to develop people. You and I have that commonality. It's kind of the basis of our original friendship. a sister from another mother. Plus, I love following you on social media. You have great posts with your family and your trips and that kind of thing. This was a book that I was super passionate about writing, helping people become more intentional with their careers. I'm a little older than you are, Carolina, but I watched people for 35 years of my career implode, skyrocket, stagnate. And as I started to research them, formally and informally, I realized that so many people's careers are accidental. Jumping here, running there, chasing that, running from this. And they're fairly episodic and way too much serendipity, in my opinion. And then I codified the people that had great careers, meaning they loved their jobs, they had influence, they were earning great money, they built a great steady trajectory, they were in control of their careers, had commonalities, right? They had a plan and they worked that plan. They did not give their career up to someone else. They didn't have a victim mentality. They accommodated serendipity, but that wasn't the definition of their career. And so I wanted to write a book that was easy to read, that had worksheets in it to help people take better control of their career. Have a plan or become part of someone else's, act or be acted upon. And the fact of the matter is, most of us aren't in the room when our career is decided for us by our boss or our boss's boss or just the CFO that says, 8% cut. And so I wanted people to take more control of their career, and that's why I wrote the book.
That is something that I tell everyone that I have career conversations with is like the most important decisions that are going to be made in your career are made in a room that you're not part of.
True. It's true. Unless you read Scott Miller's book, Career on Course, and start to take control of your career. Of course, you can't expect every recession, although they're pretty cyclical and you know when they're coming,
Right.
right? And you can't expect when your company is going to buy a new company and merge it or divest a company. There are outliers in every career. Industries come, industries go, stuff happens. But I think actually you can control the vast majority of it and anticipate it if you're aware, ask good questions, you're well connected, and you have options, which is why strategy 10 is, dig your well before you're thirsty, so that you're not caught off guard. I think more careers need to be owned by that person than them blaming someone else or giving responsibility up to someone else.
That is so true. One thing, I've been in HR for 20 years and have hundreds, if not thousands, of career conversations with people.
Yeah, right.
And you can always tell two distinct groups of people, right? There's the people that are waiting for someone to tap them on the shoulder to tell them what skills to build, what opportunities to pursue, or to give them the opportunities in a silver platter. And you have the group of people that have read your book and are taking charge of their career. I use the analogy being the driver's seat of your career, maybe because I
Yes.
spent 20 years in the auto industry, but same concept, right? Be very intentional with your career, which I love the theme of the book. And from all the times that you and I have spoke, we think so similarly.
We do.
But I want to go back to how this has personally impacted me. So, 2 years ago, I made a decision after 13 plus years of working in the previous company to make a career move. And chapter one of your book is the one thing that helped me make that decision, which is know your professional values. It was so eye-opened to me, Scott, because I have my personal values. I remember the first time that I identified them was when I took the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, right? On habit two, I identified my personal values for the first time. But then you came and said, what about your professional values and how are those imbalanced? And it was such an eye-opener for me when I start thinking about what are my professional values that helped me make that decision so clear in my mind. Can you expand a little bit on what is a little bit of the essence of chapter one of your book, Know Your Professional Values?
Carolina, I mean, you're a people expert, And so I'm delighted at your endorsement of it because I'll be honest, it's been kind of controversial. You know, all of the self-appointed values experts have trolled me all over social media because they say, no. You only have one set of values. Scott's wrong. I'm like, wait, did you get like a PhD in values? Really? I mean, so whatever. But I haven't changed my mind because I think it's a nuance. I mean, maybe it's two segments within your values. The point is, I don't think the vast majority of people know what their values are. I think if you were to ask people, what do you value? Oh, I value liberty and freedom of speech and choice. Whatever, great. I don't think most people have done what you and I have done, which is take the time to codify and write down and prioritize their personal values, which are different, I think, than your professional values. Like you, I learned this through a Franklin Covey experience. I went to a speech of one of our co-owners and I left and took 3 days and wrote down my personal values: purpose, health, integrity, loyalty, positivity, abundance, and learning. PHILPAL, PhilPAL. And 18 years ago, I memorized it and I live my life pretty fiercely in accordance with purpose, health, integrity, loyalty, positivity, abundance, and learning. But those aren't my professional values. That's not the lens through which I make all of my decisions. My career isn't my purpose. My purpose, I think, is to honor my creator, keep my marriage together, and launch these three sons of ours into the world with the skills and the conscience they need to thrive. My professional values are maximize my income because I'm the sole provider for my entire family financially. Second is to work with and for a brand that I like and trust and respect. And third is to work with people that I like and love and like and love me. And so I advocate that you need a set of personal values and professional values to know when they are in alignment, when they are in conflict, when they will change based on your roles. My values will change. I hope my professional value isn't always to maximize my income. I hope someday my children will be off the dole and I can do things I love, not things I have to, because quite frankly, I work for a living. My avocation isn't my vocation. I like to drink champagne. I can't figure out a way to earn a living on that. And I have to earn a living so I can buy my champagne. You get the point. I like that it resonated with you because it has been somewhat controversial. And you know, I don't shy from controversy. I believe people whose careers are not on course, it's because A, they haven't determined the course yet, and B, they haven't identified what are their values professionally. It might be title, it might be equity, it might be security, it might be flexibility, international assignments, it might be a big budget or an expense account. I don't care what your values are, but you ought to know them, and your career decisions should be made through those lenses. For example, I know people in sales that are in a bit of a career cul-de-sac. They can't get out of it. I'll talk to them and I'll say, but you don't live in your territory and you have a face-to-face job. Well, yeah, but I can fly in, once a month and such. And I say, but your number one goal is to maximize your income as a salesperson. But your number one personal value in family and your life is your family. It's being near your grandfather. I love that. But you can't move to Sacramento, which is your territory, because your number one personal value is family. I love that. But those are in conflict. And you have to decide, are you going to be okay with that? Maybe you're going to move to Sacramento when your grandfather passes away. And they say, oh my gosh, I never thought about that. Yeah, maybe I need different values, or I just need to realize that my personal value is going to trump my professional value and be okay with that until my roles change. Maybe I'm simplifying. I think it's an epiphany for most professionals.
Yeah, it was for me. I mean, I do think that the more you can align both, the better. And when you're
Yes.
making decisions, the more you're close to both is important.
Right.
But a lot of times when you only look through the lens of one or the other, if they're not aligned, you are creating a conflict for yourself. And then you end up being disengaged or regretting your decision.
Or not having a
It was super
strategy,
helpful
right?
for me.
Yeah. Thank you. My fear, and I know you want to move on, my fear was that people would see this and say, oh, values, another person telling me about my values. I want to be the last person telling the reader, no, take some time, sit down this weekend and really think about what your values are and how does your time align to that, and think about your professional values. What do you really care about? If your number one value is to be on the executive team or in the C-suite or have a VP title or move to Belgium, great. Write it down, codify it, and go make it happen. But don't blame other people that you don't have an international assignment when you're working for a company that has one foreign office. You made your decisions not based on your values. You made them based on who recruited you, how desperate you were, how much you disliked your current leader. I don't know.
I
I'm
think that
passionate, can you tell?
is so true. And I think, like for me, it was, again, it was an eye-opener. It helped me make the decision. But I think also a lot of people that are not clear, because I think this chapter is about gaining clarity, but also being brutally honest with yourself. I love how you very openly say, my number one professional value is income. Which a lot of people, for fear of being judged, for whatever the reason, they would never say that. You always hear things like, oh, I'm purpose driven, I'm growth driven. Yeah, but what is true for yourself? Because if you keep telling these things that is not what you really value, you end up convincing yourself of something different. And that is just someone else, right? Making the decision for you.
That is so beautifully said. I think it's really important on this topic, and I like that we're still discussing it, is your values are your values. You shouldn't care what I think about your values. You should not pick your values based on if you think they'll sound popular or, I mean, it's a tough exercise. You have to block out what anybody else thinks. Now, if you're married or in a committed relationship, maybe your partner's or spouse's opinion is that, if I said to my wife, my number one personal value is playing tennis, she might say, really? Like, where does the family fit in that? And where does the power bill fit, right? And you get the point. I think you should inoculate yourself against the opinions of others on your values. Second, although my number one professional value is maximize my income, it's not at all cost. I could have gone to work for a company and it could have made more money. But it may not have been a company I respected and worked for, and a product I believed in, and with people that I loved. I probably could have gone and worked for a hedge fund and maybe hated my job and made a lot more money, but I don't know that I would have had the same friends and lifelong relationships as I had at the Franklin Covey company. Maybe I would have. The point is, it wasn't as if my only value was maximize my income. I wanted to maximize it, but I also wanted to work for a brand that I love with people that I like.
So good. I want to jump to another strategy that you talk about in the book that I'm personally so passionate because I think is the foundation for everything, and that is self-awareness. You call it study yourself, but I am such a fan of developing self-awareness, and you tackle this from the perspective of career. Can you speak a little bit of the importance of self-awareness and how you can go about getting to know, or as you say, study yourself, because I think you have some great strategies there that someone who doesn't know where to start, like you have even the templates on the book, like the tools, everything is given to those that are reading the book to really grow their self-awareness.
I so feel like you and I are going to write a book together someday. I don't know why that's in my blood, but I feel like you and I see the world very differently from different backgrounds, right? Let me see, 35 years in my professional career, I have interviewed hundreds of people for jobs. I have hired 100 people. And I've had the responsibility of terminating about 20. Tough, right? Some more difficult than others. Some were litigious. Some were physical. People spat at me. People, grabbed me. I mean, being a leader is tough. It's not for everybody.
No.
Every single termination was not related to their lack of technical competency to do the job they were hired for. They had the certificate, they had the degree, they had the know-how. Every single termination was because the person had no idea what it was like to be around them, to work with them, to collaborate with them, to lead them, to stand in a trade show booth for 3 days with them, to be on a Zoom call with them, to work on a project. They completely lacked self-awareness. They had no idea what a train wreck and a cancer they were, either as, a problem identifier or a victim mentality or a gossiper or the person who just ran roughshod over everybody or never took responsibility. Whatever it was always the case. They had no idea how they were perceived, how they were received. It was a huge disconnect between how they saw themselves. I mean, at least I know I can be fatiguing. I have like this indefatigable energy level. I use my hands. I'm passionate about everything. I think I'm always right. I can laugh about it. I can listen. I can be quieter. I can admit when I'm wrong. This chapter is kind of the opposite of what most of us are told to do. I think we're told in organizations, you've got to be more curious, you've got to be more literate, you've got to know this author and Jim Collins and Liz Wiseman and Susan Cain and Seth Godin and Dan Pink and read all the literature and HBR and Wall Street Journal and TED Talks. And that's good. Do all of that. We all study other people. I know every song Pink has ever written. I know Roger Federer's tennis career. I've read every book Seth Godin has written. But how much time do we spend studying ourselves? What's it like to go to dinner with Scott Miller? What's it like to have Scott Miller as a guest on your podcast? I mean, look at me. I've talked 90% of the time. At least I know it. And so this chapter is about building your self-awareness. And in this, like all 10 chapters, I offer worksheets. This one, I tell people that you should build a team. I suggest a team of eight. Four people in your personal life, four people in your professional life, people you trust, people that are mature, wise, have good self-regulation, are respected, influential people, people that know you. And they all don't need to be your champions. Some of them could be your detractors. And you ask them two questions. What do I do that delights you? And what do I do that annoys you? And then just listen and document it. And if they tell you, which some of them won't, because most people aren't good at giving high courage feedback, as you know, if and when they tell you what you do that annoys them and delights them, then you can say, gosh, that's so helpful. Let me go and throw up for a moment. And when I come back and I ask you some clarifying questions, like, when do I do that? And why do you think I do that? And was there an instance when I did that that you can tell me so I remember what was going on? Was I feeling insecure? Was I feeling jealous? Was I feeling threatened? Or was it just like my natural style that, quite frankly, in some cases is a strength, in some cases it's a weakness, and I just need to be more aware when what I think is my strength, when it's overplayed, it actually hurts people and it hurts my brand. This chapter is about taking time to study yourself and see yourself more how others perceive you, less how you perceive you.
Yes.
Huge gap in this for everyone.
I know. I firmly believe that in general, we all go to work because since we're talking about our careers with the best of our intentions.
Absolutely.
But how that translates or how other people receive that might be very different than what is in our minds, right? When I left my previous company, the last thing that I did was a 360 evaluation. I gather and I use those questions that you're suggesting in your book, plus some others. But I told myself, we know people struggle to give you the critical feedback. I'm like, especially if you're in HR, and it's normal, right? But I'm like, okay, I'm leaving. They have nothing to lose to give me the feedback now. This is my chance. And that was one of the very last things that I did. And then I spent a whole weekend reading through it,
And I have to admit that the things that annoyed people about me was hard, right? To read the feedback, because that is never was my intention. As I think for everyone, it's not our intention to annoy others or to disrupt others in any negative way. But then I took everything and I'm like, okay, this is so powerful because I'm starting a new job. No one knows me. I have a chance, a blank slate to create my own personal brand. If I were to ask the same questions to the people I'm about to meet and work with, what I would like them to say about me, and how can I use the feedback to adjust? And there were things that I consciously decided not to change because they're core to who I am, right? That core to my values, and I wasn't willing to change them. Getting the feedback doesn't mean that you're gonna react and change everything that you get feedback around, but you get to choose, right? And the just the self-awareness is so powerful. There was a lot of aha moments on, oh, I can see how they think that, even though my intention was completely different.
I
Which
don't
leads
need to
me, oh,
comment
go ahead.
on that. That was beautifully said. As you were talking, I was thinking, why is she not writing a coaching book? I mean, this is great content coming from you. I have nothing to add to that. I think that is perfect what you just said.
And I think this leads very well into strategy five in your book, which is define and build your brand, because self-awareness is the basis for that, I believe. And in your book, you talk about how, which I so much agree with, we all have a personal brand. Whether you have intentionally built it or not, we all have one. Whether you're aware of what your brand is or not, you have one. So why not be intentional about building your brand? Can you expand a little bit on this topic of building your personal brand?
Or rebuilding it, right? I mean, this
Or
is not
rebuilding it?
this is not like a new aha. It's not an epiphany. We all know this, but I don't think, to quote you, that we curate our brand intentionally. I mean, I'm a literary agent, right? So I have a client that's writing a book about origin stories. Like, why are we the way we are? As a 56-year-old husband and dad and entrepreneur, I'm often accused of being like a micromanager, bit of a control freak. I like to manage things. I don't like to be caught with my guard down, right? I like to control as much of my life as I can. And this guy asked me like four questions, and I realized, oh my gosh, I had no idea. I'm this control freak because my mother was raised by two alcoholics, and so she became like this manager because her life was so out of control. And my mom did a lovely job of raising us. But I am my mother, and I guess I never really put that together. My personality is different in terms of, the things I tried to change, but I started to realize my brand is the way it is, not because I'm a sociopath or a narcissist. My wife might agree on the second one, but I'm the way I am because of how I was raised. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not a mean person, not a bad person. I just have a vision for how things should look. And I want that to be that way. Unfortunately, sometimes at the expense of relationships and people feeling respected and valued and empowered and nurtured. The point of that tirade was, that's my brand. And I've kind of come to own it and understand, okay, so how can I still have a quality standard, but make people like working with me? And feel like I'm naming their genius and empowering them and growing their skills and not diminishing them. Because, I don't shy from conflict. My wife says I'm a heat-seeking missile for conflict. I'm very comfortable giving feedback, sometimes too comfortable, right? This chapter is about understanding what do you think your brand is? Interviewing three people, I think it was three in the book, how do they perceive your brand? And then asking yourself, what do you really want your brand to be? Because it's never too late. What do you think it is? What do they say it is? Which is true, right? Your opinion doesn't matter. And then what do you really want it to be? And then what do you need to do differently? How do you need to change your mindset and your behaviors? Like, here's a great example. I'm a very loyal person, but I can be a harsh person. Like I mentioned, I don't shy from conflict. If you've done something that is, in my opinion, unacceptable or inferior quality, I'm going to tell you, like probably in private, but I mean, you're going to get it from me with no minced words. And then I'm the kind of guy that
I
would say,
hope we had more people like that in the workplace,
well,
by the way, Scott.
it's true. It's a skill. By the way, I have to be careful because I have so much courage that if I'm not deliberate and thoughtful, I can damage someone. I can damage their self-confidence or their self-esteem. So what I lack is the diplomacy and the consideration. Because I'm a pretty, being on the end of feedback from me can be eviscerating. As you know, I'm a stutterer. I've had a lifelong speech impediment. And one of my coping mechanisms is I'm a voracious reader, so I have a pretty big vocabulary. Stutterers need a big vocabulary. When a word comes up we can't say, we have to have an alternative word. Now, the upside of that is some might call me well-spoken. The downside is I'm known to weaponize my vocabulary against you. I'll use it to minimize you consciously and subconsciously. Because I'm a human, and humans have agendas, and human has flaw has have flaws. And so I'm really working on how can I keep my quality standard without eviscerating you, without making you feel, without my clarity and my conciseness not coming across as cold and unfeeling. That's my brand. I'm working on it because people have told me that because I asked them. No one's ever walked up to me and said, "You are well spoken, but a jerk." Well, actually, they probably have. And I probably took them aside and said, "Tell me more. Tell me more. Because I don't want to be a jerk."
But that is a skill that
Oh,
is so
yes. Oh,
powerful, right?
yes.
Not just emotionally react to that feedback, but try to go deeper to understand, right? And have the vulnerability to say, tell me more because I want to be better.
That is a skill. People will say to me all the time, "Scott, you're so great at role-playing these courageous conversations." And I say, "Yeah, because I screwed up the first 50 of them. Why do you think my human resource file is an expandable folder? It's because I said things that were wrong. And I have to role-play them now and be more deliberate and be more mindful of my body language, of my tone." People will say, "Scott, why are you screaming?" I'll say, "I'm not screaming. I'm just passionate." They say, "No, why are you screaming?" "I'm not screaming. Scott, want me to record it for you?" People will say to me, "Scott, why are you angry?" "I'm not angry. I'm just passionate." "No, Scott, you look angry." "I'm not angry." And I said, "Scott, can I take a snapshot? I look pretty angry." My point is, if you want to be aware of how you are received by others, between studying yourself, the third strategy, and really building this brand, it requires you to make it safe for other people to tell you their truth about how they experience you. You won't use all of it. Some of it won't be helpful, right? Some people who give feedback to me about me is more about their ex-husband who acts like me or their ex-boss who looks like me. So I have to be careful to recognize not everybody has my best success at heart. Some people that are good people still have bad intentions. And so I have built a group of people around me that I know have my best intentions at heart, and I listen intently to everything they say about me. I have a coach who tells me she turns off most of the time when I speak because she thinks I'm always in selling mode, persuasion mode, or influence mode. Duh, I was a sales leader for 25 years. I was a chief marketing officer, sales and marketing. Of course, I'm always in selling mode. I'm a literary agent. I'm an author, right? And so, but I have to be thoughtful around, okay, so how do I calibrate my style and my brand so that she doesn't turn me off and think I always have, by the way, this is a very dear friend of mine, but she tells me, "Yeah, I'm done with you," because it's like Charlie Brown's teacher. I'm tired of talking to you. She actually would say, "I wish I was talking to you. You do all the talking, Scott." So, you got to have deliberate intentions with who you ask to be on your team about your brand as well.
Totally. I want to go back. I know I skipped the order of how
Fine.
you structure the book, and there is so much intention on the way you structure the chapters. Like they're meant to be read and gone through the exercises in that order for a reason. But if I go back, one of also my favorites I guess I can say that of almost all of them, but it's how to recalibrate your long-term plan. And I know you and I have talked about this, like when people ask me, what is the one career advice you can give me? One thing, if you could only tell me one thing, I always tell people, think two steps ahead.
Yes.
Like it's never about the next job, because that's not the job you're going to retire from unless you're 65 and you're already thinking on retirement. So don't look at the next job as the end of the game. The next role is just a milestone to prepare you to where you actually want to go. And you approach in a very, you use different words, but very similar in concept when developing a long-term plan. And by the way, can I say that I'm amazed of the fact, you know, I always tell people your plan can always change. But in your book, you talk about how you wrote yours on a napkin when you were, what, 23? And you had followed it to a T since then. But can you explore a little bit on this concept of long-term planning? You mentioned it at the beginning, you need a plan. How you go about creating a career plan?
Okay, half your subscribers just hung up when they realized that I wrote out my career plan on the back of a napkin. It actually was a placemat from TGI Fridays. When I was 23 years old, I was living in Orlando working for the Walt Disney Company, and I'd just been out of college. And I turned over the paper placemat and I sketched out like my 50-year career. But here's the chapter, to quote you, again, everybody I meet, they're talking about what's next. And I say, no, 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 no. You need to think about what's after, what's next. You're playing checkers. You should be playing chess. And I'm not very good at either, but I know the rules of both. My boys all beat me in chess. That's because chess was a course in their school. They had to take chess, and I loved that. Like the one reason I had them still at that school. Many of us are living in a short-term world, and we've got to think more long-term, right? We're so validated on quarterly performance and speed and fast and information retrieval. And it's difficult to think more long-term. I'll tell you, the best advice I ever got in my life was from Franklin Covey's chairman, Bob Whitman, when he said to me, Scott, I was on the executive team as the CMO. He said, thinking is a legitimate business activity. Meaning, close your door, put your feet up on your desk, turn off your computer at 11 o'clock in the morning and put up your arms and stare out the window or whatever your version of that is and just think. Your people, your plan, your strategy, your market position, your brand, your competition, your career. I love this concept of thinking is a legitimate business activity because none of us create intentionally much time for that in our lives. And some of us think if someone's in their desk just doing nothing, they're doing nothing. Maybe they could be thinking to the chapter. The chapter is really about creating a long-term, multi-decade plan. Not just like 2 years from now or 5 years from now, but what I suggest is, no, what's the ultimate? Like when you're 58, do you want to be the CEO? Do you want to be the CHRO? Do you want to be the Western Region Sales Vice President? Do you want to be on the city council? Do you want to be the superintendent? Do you want to be the provost? Like, What is it for you? For me, it was CEO. In my 20s, I thought, you know, I want to run for Congress someday, and I want to be able to self-fund my campaign and not be subject to special interest. Therefore, I'll need about $3 million. Now it's about 12. just so happens I got married. My wife said, oh, hell no, you're not running for Congress. You have three kids. Kiss that dream goodbye. And therefore, I did. So I bought a convertible instead. That was my difference between public service. I bought a convertible. My point is, I wanted to be CEO. And so I backcasted instead of forecasted. Well, if I want to be the CEO, I've probably got to be in the C-suite. I'm never going to become the CFO or the CIO. So I became the CMO. And then I probably had to be an EVP and an SVP and a VP and an AVP and a director. You get the point, right? And I probably need supply chain experience and marketing experience and operations and probably some international experience. That's why I went to London for a year and on and on and on. And I put my age, the title, and the compensation at every one of these trench marks. So when I'm 27, I'll be here. When I'm 31, I'll be there. 33, 37, 41, 45, 55. And I put my age, the title, and the amount I wanted to make. And then I wrote out after interviewing people, I went around Disney and I met people who were managers and directors and vice presidents and EVPs. And I said, what are the skills you had to learn to earn that job? And then that job. And then like some crazy maniacal nerd, I wrote it all out on a sheet of paper, including all of the talents and skills I had to learn to move up into the next job. And then I just worked that plan for 25 years. And I pulled it out every 18 months and I readjusted. And it actually was more of a linear line than most people would believe. Yes, there was serendipity. Yes, there were some disruptions, mostly done by me, one of the strategies. But at the end of the day, I had a plan and I worked it. And that's how my career was on course. Yeah. I strongly advise people, if you buy the book, there are worksheets for every chapter, including this, that allow you to like sketch it out. And you're not going to do it perfect, right? I mean, you know, Carolina's role is going to change a little bit different and she might make a title leap, but it might be a lateral in pay, but it's a great investment long-term and she's going to have a huge jump in pay. Maybe she'll go to Asia for 2 years, never expected that, but that's on her way to the plan. The point is, although it's pithy, it's so true. Have a plan or be part of someone else's. Act or be acted upon. Your career cannot be on course if you don't know what the course is. And it doesn't mean there won't be interruptions, things you never realize, industries that pop up. But those should be the outliers, not the through line.
Yeah. I mean, I take my hat off because I thought I was a planner nerd when it comes to my career. But then when I find out about you having by age, salary, all of these details on your plan, I'm like.
But you know, can I tell you, I'm actually a fairly spontaneous person, right? I mean,
you
I have
are.
No idea. So, I mean, you know, I might buy a car this afternoon. I might choose to sell our home. I might choose to, you know, I'm a very spontaneous person. But I realized by watching all these careers in my 20s, my deduction was that the people who seem the happiest, that are the most in control in their career, are the ones that are closest to having a plan.
Mm-hmm.
They have their eyes set on something. It isn't just, and they weren't like these, just, they weren't these, you know, wildly ambitious people. They just understood how the process works. You don't make it to the C-suite because of any reason other than you earned your way there.
Yes.
And the way you earn your, I mean, in a public company, I don't know anybody who vaults into the C-suite. I mean, you know, and by the way, I'm not a very patient person, but I understood in this company, here is the culture. And so I'm going to have to adapt to understand their plan. And if it doesn't work for me, then I need to leave, but that's how it works there. And so because I was clear on my professional values, I was able to exercise maybe a little more unnatural patience, and it worked out beautifully for me. And if everybody knows the real story, you know, Franklin Covey Company is a Utah-based company, and although a public company, you know, I wasn't exactly the typical Utah guy, if you know what I mean, from Orlando, Florida. And so
the first time you and I met, I asked you very direct, probably out of place question on, you don't seem the person that fits in the Franklin Covey culture.
Well, I didn't. This is a company that I am an unabashed ambassador for. I don't work there anymore. I still consult for them and advise them and host two podcasts. But you're right. I was a total fish out of water for 25 years. You know, Utah is known as the state where it's predominantly populated by Latter-day Saints, known colloquially as Mormons, right? I was a single Catholic boy from Orlando. And these were people that were married, right, when they were 20s with five kids. I had great mentors in the company. Your religion does not matter at the Franklin Covey Company, nor does your race or gender or sexuality or orientation. It doesn't matter. But companies have cultures, period, right? And I was able to understand, okay, what do they value here? What do they value? And can I get close to that without being disingenuous to who I am? And I think there's wisdom in that, right? Is I think listeners, you might need to make a little more concessions than sometimes you're willing. Not on your ethics, not on your, you know, your black or whites, but companies have cultures and they're hard to change. And the most successful people are those that understand the culture, understand how stuff gets done here, what types of behaviors are valued and what types aren't valued. Quite frankly, I was probably a big mismatch for Franklin Covey culturally, but they knew my work ethic, my intent. I made a lot of sacrifices. I moved like 5 times. I worked very hard. And I'll have to tell you, emotionally, they rewarded me for it. The CEO and the chairman took great care of me, and we're very good friends to this day. With lots of disagreements, right? I mean, I'm a fish out of water there. But I love them and they love me.
Yeah.
Mostly. Mostly.
One thing I want to add to what you just said, because I think, again, all these chapters really resonated with me. I always tell people, you should be working now, not on the skills that you need now or in the next role, but 3 years from now. Like when you have, for me personally, right, when I have applied to a job, I always felt confident because it was in my plan. And I had worked on the skills that I needed to do that job probably 3 years ago. I think in 3 year cycles, which they're getting shorter and shorter now, right? I think we have this need to reinvent ourselves more frequently now that we did when I started my career.
Yeah.
And then there's this other layer of the company culture and the unwritten rules of the company, right? What is required and expected for you to get to a certain place, and getting to know what those things are, and then making the decision, to your point, am I willing to do those things or not?
Yeah.
Like moving internationally, like, you know, relocating, things like that, that a lot of times people have these ambitions to get to be the CEO or the CFO or whatever the role is, but they're not willing to do what the company expects of someone that would get there. And I think the earlier you get to know those things and make the conscious decision of, is this something that aligns with my values? Is something that I'm willing to do? The better. Otherwise, you find yourself in a point of, you basically disappointment. And the only one's fault is yours for not having analyzed that, right? And make that conscious decision. You let someone else make that decision for you.
I have nothing to add to that. That was beautifully said, truly.
Okay, I know time is going by so quickly. I have so many questions for you. There is one more thing, or we can chime a lot of things. I hope that everyone who is listening, they're starting to see how these things come together,
yes,
right? They're not isolated.
Right.
It's a puzzle, and you need all the pieces to have your career on course. One of the things you talked about is be willing to disrupt yourself and do it before you get disrupted. I think this is so powerful. And having that willingness to do that is something that a lot of time that I see not everyone has. They're kind of waiting to react to the last minute versus being proactive and disrupting themselves. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Carolina, when people ask me, like, what's the one thing you did in your career that was the most successful, that got you to the C-suite, that got you to write a book now, you know, a best-selling book on careers, I say, you know, it was just that, is I had the courage, and maybe it was like the fearlessness, or maybe sometimes the irresponsibility of disrupting myself. I was just kind of always horrified that someone else would make decisions about my career. I'm like, no, you don't make decisions about my career. It's my career. Now, I understand I'm an employee and there are norms and there are processes and values and things that will get me fired or get me promoted. But that
By
just
the
stopped.
Way, he talks about all of those things. On
I do. I do. I do. I do. Was my willingness to disrupt myself. I did not want to be the person ever. And maybe it's because I'm paranoid, because I run a little bit paranoid, which is a good thing and a bad thing. I'm Catholic. It kind of comes with the territory. I never wanted someone to say, yeah, Scott's kind of past his prime there. You know, we should maybe move him out, because I was part of those conversations about other people. And so I read this book from Whitney Johnson called Disrupt Yourself. Whitney Johnson has written many books, fantastic podcaster, consultant, coach, speaker, author. And Whitney says the research shows, Carolina, that on average, we tend to master our jobs between 18 and 36 months. And at the end of that time period, you know, I'm not going to say any of us phone it in, but we become a little more complacent and the challenge, the excitement, the euphoria is kind of worn off. And the problem is that subconsciously we become a little bit complacent and we don't notice it, but those around us do. Other people notice it before we do, and then they start making judgments on, well, I mean, you know, he's not stretching himself or she's not in a growth mindset or whatever it is. And I think it's a dangerous trap for a lot of people. I hope those that are still listening to us are tuning in tight right now. You probably don't think this applies to you. Oh, it does. The psychology science shows that once you have mastered a job, somewhere between 18 and 36 months, it does get easier. And the point is, whether you still have a great work ethic, other people are seeing in you perhaps some complacency, and that impacts your brand. So the moral of the story is, are you in a position to disrupt yourself? Some people aren't. Some people are single parents. Some people are caregivers to their parents. Some people don't have the financial traction. I don't want to seem like I'm disconnected. I mean, I'm not. I told you, I am the sole financial provider for a wife who likes Gucci and three kids who apparently want to go to college and have tennis lessons and have braces and go to Barnes & Noble and go on vacation once a year and apparently have a Christmas stocking and an Easter basket and a whole lot of other opportunities. And so I am not this guy that's independently wealthy and just like quits my job and I went, no, I mean, my wife wants insurance. Go figure. And so I have a lot of anchors that keep me from being frivolous. But in every job that I've moved out of, it was me. Other than Disney inviting me to depart 30 years ago, who cares? I have moved myself out of every job way before anybody would ever think I was complacent. And people would say, Scott, you're quitting like a six-figure job. Scott, you're quitting a seven-figure job in the pandemic. And I know I'm done. They need someone new. What I could contribute got them there, but I was mature enough to say, I can't take them there. That needs someone else's skills. And that doesn't mean that I'm not competent. It means that's not my competency. And I'm choosing not to learn that. I'm choosing to do something else now. Yes, you have to prepare yourself financially. Yes, you have to have a big network. Yes, you have to constantly be challenging your skill set and reinventing yourself and moving and failing. I have failed my way to success 100%. And even that's probably debatable, the success piece. I'm very comfortable talking about it. The lesson in this one is you're going to be disrupted. And some of you can't control, but I think you can control the vast majority of it. If you keep your ear to the ground, you build a network, you reinvent yourself, you see the writing on the wall, and you are the person that says to your boss, you know, I'm really proud of how I've gotten us to here. And I see we need to go there. And I'm not sure I'm the right person or that that's the best use of my talent and passion and energy to learn that. I don't want to jeopardize my income or my position, but we probably should talk about what does my path look like? Because I'm not sure that path is right for you or for me. Can we talk about what else could be available? Now, that might not be a conversation you can have with your boss because she or he doesn't think holistically, doesn't think strategically, doesn't have the elasticity. You may be in a small company, right? There's not a lot of upward mobility in a Subway shop. So choose your declaration carefully. But if you choose your leader carefully, you'll work for someone that says, wow, that is a really bold conversation. You didn't just quit your job, but you're thinking about the business as much as you're thinking about your career. And I honor and value that. And I'm telling you, 90% of leaders will say, oh my gosh, where do we put Carolina? Because quite frankly, we all kind of knew you weren't right for that. And we've been talking about that, but we kind of hoped you'd rise to the occasion. But thank you for acknowledging it. Oh, we're so going to find the right role for you because we want your self-awareness and maturity in this company. Oh, you're going nowhere. Let's figure out where to get you. And some people may think that's Pollyanna, but I'm watching Carolina shake her head, who was a senior people development person in a global company. And that's how it works in the right organizations with the right leaders.
That's how it works. And I would say before you get to the point of even quitting your job or getting to this, there's so much you can do in preparation for that to, on an ongoing basis, disrupt yourself and put yourself outside of your comfort zone and continue to stretch yourself. It was so eye-opening for me, Scott, when I switched jobs. Like, I thought I still was learning in my previous job. And then when I switched companies, I realized how much I had been on a comfort zone.
Yeah.
When I had to learn a new industry, learn a new company, build a new network. A lot of times you don't realize that you're getting complacent, to your point. And there's a lot of things you can do without taking this, I'm going to call it, drastic decision.
Yes.
To prepare
yes.
yourself for the time when you're ready to make the decision.
Beautifully said. I know our time is coming to a close here. This is also a great conversation for leaders. All of your talent is up for bid right now on LinkedIn. If you don't think every one of your associates is being courted and recruited, you're delusional. They're all being courted and recruited. And so before one of your employees is thinking about disrupting themselves, go to them and have these conversations and say, how are you feeling? What do you see about your future? Is this the right role? By the way, some people will be paranoid and say, is it not? Is it, are you firing me? No, I love you and I care about you. And I want to make sure we have all the talent in the right place. And if you want to stay in this, man, I'll be your champion if that's the truth. But leaders, listen to me. All of your talent is being recruited right now as you're listening to this podcast. Every one of your people, whether they're doing it proactively or reactively, there still is a hot labor market for in-demand talent, and they can afford to pay them more because you've made all the investments and you've trained them and matured them. So of course they can offer more money because you've done all the hard work investing in your people. Don't be asleep at the wheel. Don't be afraid to have career conversation with your people to say, how's it going? What are you feeling? What is your future? What is your five-year plan? How can we be a part of that? Because I think, again, to use the phrase, most leaders are pretty good at recruiting talent. Most leaders suck at retaining talent.
So well said. I know we're up on time. I can speak with you for hours about this or any other topic. Thank you so much, Scott, for being here one more time on the podcast. As always, I always enjoy. It's a pleasure talking to you. I always learn from you. You are a great mentor. Everyone who is listening, go grab a copy of the book. If you have any career goals this year, you need this book. It's the roadmap to be intentional about your career.
Thank you, Carolina, for your friendship. Thank you for the spotlight. I love our conversations. I just think there's a collaboration in the future. We got to stay in touch outside of you helping me spotlight my new books, which I'm super grateful for. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Scott.